Begin PodFix Network transmission. In 3, 2, 1.
Whether you're fly fishing in a stream, getting those ankles wet, or deep in the ocean casting nets, fish nerds. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. It's a podcast.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Fish Nerds show about fish, fishing, and eating fish. I'm Clay Groves, Chief Executive Fish Nerd, Licensed Fishing Guide, your best friend. Wow, it's been a long time since I've made a podcast, and I'm happy to be back. Been very, very busy all summer. I don't usually make a lot of podcasts in the summer because of my fishing business, my fishing guide service I run all summer long. It just keeps me too much time in the water, not much time in front of the computer. And then this fall, I was getting ready to come back on, and I got asked to audition for a production of Young Frankenstein the musical. And of course, I surprisingly, not of course, but then I end up becoming the monster in Young Frankenstein the musical. That wraps up this weekend. This weekend being the last weekend of October. And then we're back. We're back to normal. Actually, not normal, because November is National Podcast Posting Month. And that means every day for the month of November, I will be dropping a new podcast. And I could use your help. I'll tell you about that in just a minute. Tonight in the podcast, it's pretty simple. I'm going to talk about National Podcast Posting Month, what I've been up to. And then I've got an interview with Doc Martin, our chief science correspondent. We've been talking about eels, American eels, or sorry, European eels. And scientists have finally discovered how the American eel migrates to the Sargasso Sea to spawn. We'll talk about that with Doc Martin. So National Podcast Month is November. And what I do for that is every year I pick a theme. And this year, a listener picked the theme. The theme is Fishing Ruined My Life. And I'll be looking for you to help me with this. I'm looking for fishing stories, fishing events that went wrong. Could be funny, could be tragic, could be mediocre. I need 30 stories. So whatever you got, you've got. I'll be dropping the first one on Tuesday. You'll get an idea for it. And it's very easy. All you've got to do is call me, 607-378-FISH, 607-378-FISH, and leave your fishing story in the voicemail, and I'll use it on the podcast. It's as simple as that. And if you've got a business you want to plug while you're at it, do it. Drop it in there. I do want to thank a business. Wyoming Whiskey has sent me a little bottle of whiskey, and I made a delicious, very, very yummy drink out of it, an old-fashioned, my favorite whiskey drink. And it is quite lovely, so I want to thank Wyoming Whiskey for sending that along. I'll talk more about them on a future episode because I do want to get into the content of this one. And again, we don't have a lot of time because I've got to get to my show tonight, but I wanted to drop this podcast into your ear holes today. And I want to thank you for sticking with the Fish Nerds. Even though we took a little break, we are back and back with a vengeance. All right, so let's get right into what I've been up to, and then I'll get right into Doc Martin. And what I've been up to is going to be very, very short. One of the big things I did this summer, I do every summer, end of the summer, is I do the the New England Paralyzed Veterans NEPVA Bass Fishing Tournament is where I take paralyzed vets or disabled vets out on my pontoon boat, and we fish a tournament. It's the only tournament I fish. I'm not generally a supporter of fishing tournaments as a rule. I don't understand them. It's like it becomes a sport to me, and sports are not my thing, but I figure for paralyzed vets, it's worth the effort. And this happened on Lake Winnipesaukee. There were 21 boats. We went out bass fishing. I had a vet on the boat and his daughter, and we went out bass fishing, and we weren't catching very many bass. And I saw, you know, out in deeper water, we were fishing like shallow water for smallmouth bass, and we saw out in deeper water lots of bass boats in like 40, 50, 60 feet of water catching bass, and I've never seen that before. It's outside the kind of fishing I usually do, and so I thought I'd give it a go. So I rolled up on one of the bass boats, and I asked them what they were doing, and they were doing drop shotting. And I've never fished a drop shot before. I read about it barely. I didn't care about it, so I thought I'd give it a go. So I Googled how to drop shot, and it was so basic. You know, take a weight, put it at the end of your string, and then a foot up, make a hoop, and tie your hook on. And then I used a Ned rubber worm, so like a 3-inch rubber worm on my regular bass hook, which is a 1-aught hook, put it on there so it's dangling. And then the only technique, and this is super basic, you drop your weight to the bottom, and you try to hold that weight on the bottom. And the action of holding your weight on the bottom is action enough for the bass to hit. And boom, before you know it, we had caught our five fish for the day, and we were able to go back and do the weigh-in and get in the tournament. Five fish was how many fish we were allowed to weigh in. And we ended up with about 11 pounds of bass, which I think is pretty good bass for bass day. And we got them weighed in, and it turns out we came in seventh place overall out of 21 boats. Not bad for someone who doesn't tournament fish. We'll talk more about tournament fishing and some of my problems with it in a future episode. And it's questionable whether I'll go back and do more. But New England Paralyzed Veterans Association is a group worth doing. I mean, these vets have given so much for us. The least we could do is take them fishing. But I wish there was a better way to weigh them in besides bringing the fish out of the lake up to a weigh station and then putting them back in the lake again. Well, again, there's some problems with that, which we'll discuss in a future episode. Woof. I hate to be rushing you, but I'm going to get you right into the conversation with Doc Martin right now. Here's Doc Martin.
Everyone, it seems, wants to get more fish in the world. It's up to you and me, girl. Come on. There's only
all right.
It's really hard not to laugh all at place.
That was made by a listener who
it's
wants
absolutely
to,
wonderful.
Who wants to remain unknown.
It's so good.
But I love it so much, and it's so perfect for this.
All right.
We're here with Doc Martin. Doc Martin is our chief science correspondent, and the only correspondent still standing after 10 years, over 300 episodes of podcasting. So.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I think so. There might be more floating back, but no one's come on in a long time, so we can edit that a little bit. There may be some hanging around, but some have made their own podcast now, and some just don't interact anymore. 10 years is a long time.
It is.
It's a long time.
It's almost unreal, but I still like fish.
Well, me too. And we're here to talk about eels, and we're going to start with a little bit of like natural history of eels, talk about a book about eels, and then some really big eel science. And that's why we played the sex, because eels are so unique in the way that they respond, reproduce, and where they reproduce. Before we get into that, Doc, for people who aren't clear, what's an eel? And we're talking about American eel and European eel specifically.
Yeah, so great question. A lot of people think if it's kind of long and tubular, it's an eel. Mm-hmm. That is incorrect. So eels are a very specific type of taxonomy. And just because it's long and slimy and has fins does not mean it's an eel. There's a lot of fish that look like eels. And so Anguilliformes is generally the family of true eels. And so they are bony fishes, which is important. They do have paired fins. So they do have two paired pectoral fins. They have a lot of the other general jaw characteristics of jawed fishes and other things like that. I think the important breakdown is things like, there's some glass lizards that some people call eel-like. And interestingly, also called snakes sometimes. Mm-hmm. They are neither. They are lizards. They just don't have legs, and they blink. So if it blinks, it's a lizard, and if it doesn't blink, it's a snake. So there's some other fun taxonomy differentiation.
I didn't know that. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So glass lizards are super cool. We have them out here in Kansas. I actually don't know a lot about their distribution. I just know that we catch them sometimes, and they blink. So
that's
you know
wild.
That they're a lizard.
All right.
And of course, you look at the internal structure too.
Right.
That's a quick and dirty rule there. So yeah. Not all long, slimy things are eels. Hagfish, again, not an eel.
Nope. How about lamprey? Not an eel.
Lamprey, not an eel.
Even though one of their common names is lamprey eel, which I hate.
No,
I hate it, but they say it.
Starfish aren't fish.
That's true.
That's all I'm saying.
Neither are jellyfish. So yeah, fair point.
Yeah. But yeah, so there are things that are true eels, and then there's lots of other stuff that can look like eels that are not eels.
Okay. I think, and if people know eels when they see them a lot of times, especially nerds listening to this show, And we want to really get into the, I want to say American eel, but this study we're going to talk about is on the European eel, which biologically is exactly the same animal. Is that right?
Yeah. It's very cool. That's really interesting. They spawn in the same place.
Right. The same population, right?
They kind of look the same, mm-hmm. but then they go different places.
They do. So this is one of those weird things. Like when I used to teach science, we teach speciation, and we would teach like how you can be geographically separate to be a species or biologically separated. But these guys are geographically separated as maturing animals, and but they come back, they're not geographically separated, and biologically, they're the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So are they two different animals because they have two different scientific names, or do we just give them names based on where they live and that's how we're going to roll with it?
So what is a species? This is actually one of my favorite topics to talk
about.
Everybody feels like they know and everybody's wrong. So if you're listening, you're wrong. Right. Unless you happen to be a scientific species taxonomist, and then you're probably right some of the time.
And then they disagree still within that community.
That's right.
So yeah. But you know, but some basic there's some basic rules of thumb that we can build species based on. You know,
it's
one of those things that's easy to say, okay, a lion is a different species than a puppy, you know.
Right.
That's an easy one. But but two, like, you know, like a grizzly bear and a polar bear, biologically almost the same animal, but they're different species, right? Like their DNA is the same. It's the same thing.
Similar-ish.
Yeah.
So, and how different is different is really the essential question that we have to end up asking. And so there's different species concepts. There's the very simple one where they just look different, so they're different. Morphologic species idea that the morphology is different, so that separates them out. There's a lot of problems with this one because people tend to think a lot of things look the same. If you've ever tried to seine in any kind of river that's large and has an abundant cyprinid population, and you don't know your species ID, you probably pulled up like 20 species, but people are like, those are all the same because they're all minnows.
You have no idea, right?
It only hurts my heart every time that is said out loud. And then there's the idea that there's, you know, the geographic species concept. So geographically, they just live in different places and so they can't reproduce. And so they are distinctly separate. And then over time that they might independently evolve. The biologic species concept where, you know, they can mate and reproduce and produce viable offspring. Evolutionary species concept. So are they, you know, evolving in the same way along similar trajectories? So this might happen, you know, hyperbole to prove a point. If an alien from the Andromeda galaxy, for reference, we're in the Milky Way galaxy. Galaxies are really, really big.
Thank you.
Comes down onto Earth and walks out of their spaceship and they look like a human. And you take their DNA, which they have, and their DNA comes back as indistinguishable from humans. We might want to call that the same species. They could interbreed with us, but clearly they came from a different galaxy that we assume has no evolutionary relationship to our own. So are they the same species? Probably a lot of us might be squinting our eyes going, ooh, I don't really like that question very much. You know, it makes me uncomfortable. And so lots of different ways to think about differentiating species. And that's what the EO gets into the weeds about.
Well, because it's a really hard one because
it's a really tough one.
Because we also look at populations and there's one population, but that separates, you know, as they mature. So it's really confusing.
Right.
And so just a little history with eels. If you don't know, you know, Doc, but listeners may not know that eels are catadromous, right? And that means they're born in salt water, live most of their life in fresh water, and then return to salt water to spawn, except for the males. Mm-hmm. They hang out in brackish water mostly. So a little bit confusing there. And I think they're the only fish that does that. Is that correct? Or that we know about?
Oh, boy.
That's what I read years ago. I think I read that in the Book of Eels or something. I read that once, and I remember it, and I don't remember where I read it. Yeah. But you can't name another one off the top of your head, I guarantee it.
I can't name another one off the top of my head, but I am not the knower of all things. So
right,
I'm a little hesitant to
say
the only one
we know about here at the Fish Nerds. And if you know one, let us know.
Okay.
And that way, because I've never heard another one, and that's how I've read it forever. I might have read that once in Northern Hemisphere. Maybe I read it differently. Now my brain is jogging something.
I don't know.
Yeah. But either way, you'll be hard pressed to find another one.
Anadromous is more common. Those are your trout and salmon.
Right.
A lot of your salmonids anyway.
Right. And also your sea lampreys.
And your lampreys, yes, yep. That's true too.
Yep. Oh, yeah. And also your temperate basses. So like
so there are lots of different ones of those.
Your striped bass and also there's a few other smaller fish too that do it. There's a lot of fish that do that. And mm-hmm. and that was a way of escaping glaciers as they came through, you know, and they can go to the ocean and be safe and come back later. But we can skip the evolution on that. Let's get into eels more.
Okay.
I really want to focus on these eels here.
Yeah, so the baby eels
yes.
Look super weird.
They're so cool looking. They're microscopic almost.
Yeah, and they look like little glass, very see-through, transparent leaves almost. So different that we didn't think they were eels at first, right? So they were classified as a totally different species until we found out that those are just how the babies look, right. Which is so insane. It's so wonderful.
It is wild, yeah.
And then as they grow up, they change colors. So one, they become not transparent. They can get pretty large. And then they can be browny, gray-ish
green.
With some modeling.
Yeah, I've seen green. I've seen greenish. Yellow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Up to silver, mm-hmm. With a nice bright silver, depending on their stage of maturity and some other, you know, just morphometric life history traits.
Yeah,
I guess.
All these changes happen as they're migrating, and when they first start the migration, they're born out near the Sargasso Sea. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about that in a minute, and yep. Then they drift in the currents till they get to the shorelines and to where they can enter freshwater systems. And mm-hmm. in that time is when they do a lot of their early growth.
Yep.
And when they get to the shoreline, I think they call them glass eels or elvers.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big market for those in Japan and China. And I know off the coast of Maine, up here where I live, it's a huge business. People collect mm-hmm. them and sell them. And then they grow them in aquaculture in Spain and China, in Japan for food. And then the females mostly enter the freshwater systems and they'll travel thousands of miles inland into Europe and United States for most of their adult life. And it could be years, 7, 14, maybe more, before they decide to head back out to the ocean to spawn. And we catch them in the springtime fishing for them in brackish water, lots of small ones, like a foot long. That's a small eel.
We got them, yeah. Myself and some colleagues have caught them in Indiana, mm-hmm. Which is, that's pretty far inland.
That's pretty far inland,
we do,
yeah.
We do have some records. I think at least one actual record out in Kansas, out here in the middle.
Yeah.
So that's like all the way.
Yeah. And what I read once is like and I've seen it. I've seen them out of the water at night. I've seen them as roadkill. So they'll cross roads and highways
oh, wow.
on rainstorms. Mm-hmm. And I've seen them out hunting in the grasses for frogs. So they'll mm-hmm. come out of the water and they'll travel at underwater rivers and underwater water bodies. And they just find their way. And they're not in a rush. They're just going. And who knows
yeah,
how they decide.
They don't rush. Their their cycle is, I mean, it's not unpredictable, but it's very strange with how long certain parts of their time take. We have a lot better idea for most other species except for eel. And for a long time, because we didn't know that they went out to the Sargasso Sea to spawn, folks, this would be kind of pre-science,
right.
Thought that they just arose from the mud.
Yes, I read that. They just kind of rise up. There they are, an eel.
Yeah, there they are from the mud.
Well, and that's interesting because that's not surprising, though, because they bury themselves down the mud. And you can see mm-hmm. their heads poking up. We had one in an aquarium for quite a long time when I worked for the Emmiskig Fishways until it escaped, which they do. They're escape
They're
experts.
Good escape artists, yes.
But it would bury itself down in the gravel, and it was great. We had it trained to feed off of our hands. We would just reach in with a worm and feed it, and after a while, you put your hand in, it would just come and just kind of slide around your arm and look for food in your hands and stuff, and it was really cute. Yeah.
That's so wonderful.
I know, it was really fun. but they're so cool. And then when they're ready to migrate back out to spawn, the females, their eyes turn this bright white color. And then they make their way slowly back out to the ocean and back out somewhere near the Sargasso Sea to spawn. And they collect the males come with them as they pass through, and they just kind of go. And for years and years, I've been saying scientists have never found eels that are ready to spawn, like a caught a wild eel that has eggs, or found where their actual spawning grounds are. And this is why this new science is a big deal to nerds like us.
Huge deal.
Yeah.
For a long time, scientists didn't even know how eels reproduced at all.
Yeah, I'm not sure we still know that.
Well, right, yeah, yeah. We don't know what mating looks like. Mm-hmm. We don't know how or where they actually do the deed. We don't know any of that. I think it was Sigmund Freud who wanted to solve the eel question and then eventually gave up and went into be a famous psychologist.
You know, that sounds familiar. Yeah. You'd think with my degree in psychology, I would have known that one thing.
But yeah, Sigmund Freud, who we all know, you know, the mm-hmm. Freudian slip.
Right. Sometimes an eel is just an eel, he once said.
Yeah. But his whole thing when he was a younger man was like, I'm going to solve the eel problem. And then he just gave up. So, mm-hmm. You know, he did other famous things, which that's a whole other podcast.
Right.
But yeah, it was too much for a lot of people to solve. And right. So we have finally direct evidence of adult European eels mm-hmm. migrating to the breeding place in the Sargasso Sea.
Right.
And this came out, this is hot off the press from, looks like Rosalind Wright and their colleagues published in Scientific Reports, which is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. It's like this is like a week ago. This is really fresh news. This is
This is like super recent. This happened. And it's just, I have a lot of feelings about it because it's really, really exciting. But when humans learn things about things, sometimes they ruin it for everybody. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, please don't ruin this. Thank you.
Right. Right. So they were tracking a bunch of, they've been trying to track eels for years.
Yes.
In fact, they've been trying to find the spawning ground since around 1920 when they first discovered baby eels floating in the Sargasso Sea. Mm-hmm. That's how we know it's in that area. And so from that point forward till now, the tracking has begun. They've been trying for years and years. So that's a long time. Was that 100 years? Yeah. 100 years in the making of just that one problem. And now mm-hmm. they've at least solved part of the European, there's probably more than one pathway these eels are taking, but they've
I would think so.
I would imagine there's thousands of different ways you can get there. But mm-hmm. they finally did. They were tracking them, and it was only a small amount of eels they were able to track. I don't remember the number. It was in single digits. But they found them. Oh, 21. It was 21 female European eels is what they tracked. And they tracked them tracked them southwest through the Azores, which is a volcanic archipelago.
Archipelago.
In the North Atlantic Ocean, west of Portugal. So that's kind of the track they were on. So just a very small number.
And they tracked them for 40 to 366 days.
Yeah, it's a long time. The average travel speed of the European eel is 4 miles per day. So that it's a long journey. It's thousands of miles.
4 miles a day.
Yeah, 4 miles a day, which is tremendously slow. It's ridiculously slow.
Although I challenge all of our listeners to tape their ankles together and then tape their arms to their sides and then see how far they get in a day.
That would be a fun challenge to watch. But the difference is eels are meant to move that way. You know, they have.
That's true. That's true. You know, isn't there's the way, slight differences.
Didn't you say God made them that way once? Yeah, funny. But longest distance they traveled was 2,275 kilometers or 1,410 miles is the longest one they tracked, which is a pretty long haul.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy.
Super crazy, but very exciting. I mean, and now that they've got a location of where this is happening, I'm gonna guess that more maybe video footage or actual notes of folks watching the spawning happen to see what do they do and how long do those steps take and all that stuff. We don't know.
Well, in some of the stuff that was surprising with this journey is that they found the eels would go down as much as 1,000 meters deep in the ocean in this traveling.
Wow.
And so they can adapt from being in shallow freshwater to down 1,000 meters deep, which is roughly 3,000 feet deep, where most things can't handle it.
That pressure change would be just, debilitating.
Yeah.
Lethal.
Yeah. And because they, like most spawning fishes, when they are traveling to spawn, it's a beeline. They are anxious to get there. Anxiety is the right word, but they want to get there as fast as they can, you know, in the most efficient way possible. Eels don't seem to be caring much about being efficient because of the way they go is not the most straight, direct route, and they're not in a hurry. They're just making their way.
Yep. Yeah, it's about the journey, not the destination for the eels.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because, like, the other things that I read a lot of the article, and I have a lot more questions than the article answered. I know the pathway they went. I read an article about the article too, and it said until now scientists have not found a female with eggs. It didn't say though in the article that they found a female with eggs. So I didn't find. Oh. I didn't find. Did they actually find a female with eggs?
The article
about the scientific journal article said until now, but then it didn't cite in that article they found females with eggs. So are they in that journey developing the eggs? Or, like, when does that happen in the journey? Because we haven't caught them anywhere else. So it's kind of a weird problem to be questioning. Like, did they actually find a spawning female? Or did they... How do you put a tracking device on a spawning female if you don't know? I don't know. There's a lot going on here with my brain as far as what are they doing?
Yeah.
When do the eggs show up? Because we haven't found eggs in eels until before then. So...
I don't know.
It doesn't. I didn't find it. I couldn't find it.
And so I'm looking at it now, and I'm like, that is a good question.
Right. So I read a summary of the journal article in a different, in a different publication because it's easier for my not scientist brain to read. So that was a question. I'm like, so did they find a whole bunch of eels in that area that were ready to drop their eggs, or did they?
Although our study did not yet yield definitive evidence of the mechanisms of navigational influence, like ocean currents, olfactory cues, temperature fronts, magnetic fields, or seamounts, ours is the first direct evidence of a migrating adult European eel reaching the presumed breeding place.
They're not 100%.
So they're not 100%, but they do have the tracking. So, and then it's a breeding female. So there's that leaves a lot of the specifics still up in the air.
Do they know for sure she was going to breed? Do they know for sure? They don't know where. They don't know the exact location.
No, they
still
don't know that.
But now they know what they know is they know one route. That eels are taking. Oh, that 20.
Well, there's 21. Did they all go the same route?
They all went roughly the same direction. Yeah.
Okay.
I think they tracked them all from the same area. They kind of all came down together. But I imagine with the distribution of these eels around the world, there's going to be hundreds of migration routes, maybe thousands.
Those have got to be.
Yeah. Because obviously American eels aren't going to go over, but maybe they would, but they probably wouldn't go over to Europe and go with those guys down. I mean, doesn't make a lot of sense, but they could.
Probably not.
Yeah. It's not out of the question. We don't know, but it seems bonkers, for nature to do that.
But this still isn't like watching anybody lay eggs. This isn't like watching spawning happening. This isn't, any of eggs hatching or anything like that. So that's still all.
So this is just the very beginning of that answer. It's not satisfying at all. It's exciting.
No,
but
it's exciting.
But it makes me want more. Right.
I think that's the human condition.
Right. but it is big news because it changes my narrative. For years, I've been saying the same thing about eels. I've been saying, and scientists have never been able to track them. And they put, tracking devices that have always failed, which was true until last week. And now.
Yeah.
Now it's not true.
Now we tracked them.
Now we tracked some, 21 of them.
Some. A very small percentage.
Yeah. So what are the implications, though, Doc? What do you think this all means?
Well, I'm worried about fishing pressure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Are they going to start dragging something through that area yet?
I mean, not necessarily from scientists, but these are valuable organisms for, the fishing industry and the food industry. And so I love that we know things, but knowing things comes with a cost that's sometimes really unfortunate. And I think that's it makes me very nervous under the surface of the excitement.
Well, because eels
to know things is cool.
Yeah, because eels have overcome a lot of human obstacles. Dams being one of the biggest ones. They've They figured out how to get around a lot of dams. Not all of them. They get pretty beat up by the dam still. They figured out how to cross the road. They figured out how to, and they figured out, they just maybe got lucky.
Dealing with land use, water quality changes, like they've endured.
Yeah, and they must be able to sustain some pretty wild water quality differences, given how far they travel around the world. They could probably handle near any water.
I don't know, but I mean, you would have to think that has to be yes, right? Otherwise,
because the distribution wouldn't be what it is. It would be a very limited distribution to certain water qualities. You see that with salmonids all the time. If it's not right, they're not there. But everything so far seems to be right for American eels and European eels. So far. But it's exciting and it's neat news. And you were talking about the Book of Eels. We were talking about that off air.
So if you're into this, if you're listening and you're like, wow, I really wish I knew more about the eels, but I don't want to read peer-reviewed science because it puts me to sleep.
It's hard.
It is. That's fair. Then I strongly recommend the Book of Eels. I don't know what year it came out. It's by Patrick Svensson. So I believe he's a Swede. So go Swedes. And gosh, I'm trying to find. Oh, it came out in 2021. That's pretty new.
It's pretty new. Yeah, I remember when it first came out. I read it and I forgot a lot of it, or I didn't integrate a lot of it. So.
Yeah. So yeah, the Book of Eels. It's got a long title: Our Enduring Fascination with the Most Mysterious Creature in the Natural World.
And I would bet you in 2022 there'll be the second edition, because they have to update all the chapters on eel tracking and migration in that book. But it's great. It's got great diagrams and some really helpful stuff with identifying eels and behavioral stuff. A lot of issues with humans interacting with eels. So it's a good read. I own it.
It's not super long.
No. I own it somewhere. But anyway, Doc, this is big news. I'm very excited about it.
Yay.
I'm also very glad to get the podcast back up off the ground again. I'm glad you're still with us.
Yes, always. I just am, busy.
That's our whole eel thing. That's all we know about the eels.
Yep.
How's the kid?
Well, she turns 4 in February.
Oh my gosh.
I know. I don't know how she is so strong-willed. It certainly has nothing to do with who her parents are.
I'll tell you a secret about kids. So remember when there's a phrase called the terrible twos?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lie. Two-year-olds are easy. Four-year-olds.
Yeah, I didn't mind. I don't mind any of the stages. Well, all the stages are different, and I enjoy all of them for different reasons. I know some people have favorites, but.
Yeah, four is the hardest. That's.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Not even teenagers?
Teenagers are different. They're hard in some other ways, because teenagers, they act out and they know they're acting out and they can't control it. They know they can't control it. So what you do with them is you pretend to be angry as a parent. And then you walk in the other room and you go, big dummy, what are you doing? And then you go back and go, I'm so mad at you. And then you go out and pretend like you got to just compartmentalize. You're just being a teenager, but you can't say it to them. So you say, well, I can see why that's so upsetting. And then you walk in the room and go, man, I'm dummy. Just how
you're gonna look back on this and be like, oh man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were all
She loves being outside. Mm-hmm. And so that's really nice, just because I also like being outside. So we spend a lot of time looking at butterflies. So we usually go out to the tallgrass prairie out here for the monarch migration in the fall, and they do a lot of tagging and catching the monarchs out at the prairie. And
perfect.
She likes to catch the butterflies. And right now she Halloween, she's going to be a shark witch.
Ah, the best kind of witch.
Yeah. So she's really into sharks and lizards right now. Mm-hmm. And then also.
And the difference between a shark and a lizard is lizards blink.
Yeah, that's the one.
The only difference.
That's the only difference between sharks and lizards.
That's science. That's really funny. Oh, good.
So it's pretty fun. She keeps me pretty busy, but I like to be a mom. It's pretty awesome.
It's a pretty good thing. I'm not a mom, but I like being a parent. So I get it.
A parent.
All right, Doc, we got to end this, because I got other things I got to get to. But
I don't have anything to get to.
mostly I have a nap I like to get to. I got to work at, got to work 3 in the morning. So noon rolls around.
Awesome. Hey, thanks, Clay. We'll have to talk again soon.
Well, so that's it. It's over. You've listened to a couple of Fish Nerds when you should have been fishing. Big thanks to Doc Martin. And thank you to you for listening and getting back into the Fish Nerds podcast. I do appreciate you all. And until next time, follow the code of the fish nerd, spawn early and often. Never trust a freelancer with strings against with strings attached. I forgot how to do this. And swim against the current every chance you get. We did it. We made a
Whether
podcast.
Whether you're fly fishing in a stream, getting those ankles wet, or deep in the ocean casting nets, fish nerds. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. It's a podcast.
Just for the halibut.
Fry it in a basket or broiled in a pan. Eat it raw like you're in Siam. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. Fish nerds. It's a podcast.